You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, August 2nd, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, executive editor of the American Prospect, David Dayan, on the collapse of the federal eviction moratorium. Meanwhile, Infrastructure Week may finally be here. We'll see. The CDC has more data on Delta as Florida surpasses its peak number of infections. Department of Justice says Treasury Department must hand over Donald Trump's tax returns to Congress. Hundreds of thousands of Afghanis flee Afghanistan as the Taliban begins to take over the country, at least parts of it. And the U.S. marginally expands its Afghan refugee program, just marginally. Big special election primaries in Ohio tomorrow. In the second half of the program, Ben Dixon, who's been on the ground with the Nina Turner forces, will be calling into the program from the road. Literally. Meanwhile, new notes found show that Trump pressed the Department of Justice hard on overturning the election, even though they could find no reason to do so. Lastly, Joe Biden facing the results of Trump's brain drain of climate experts. All this and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for joining us. Joining me, as always, Emma Vigeland. Hello, Emma.
Hello, Sam.
Now, you have a real bounce in your step because some sports thing happened. Is that right?
Well, I mean, it's not... I don't celebrate injuries, right? I never do that. I'm always rooting for the player, but
I honestly don't know if I've seen you with this like level of enthusiasm. I've never seen you so animated.
That's inaccurate. There have been way more consequential sports things that I think got me more animated in front of you. But this was one, as I've told you, I am high on Mucinex.
Right, of course.
I feel odd.
Why is today any different than any other day?
I was unaware that Mucinex has this kind of power over people. I don't take it regularly. I took it this morning. And, geez, there's some strong stuff in here. This is why they make meth out of it, right?
I don't know.
Okay, but anyway.
But I'll take your word for it.
Audience, Carson Wentz has made the wise decision to get surgery on his foot.
Nobody knows who that is.
Yes, everybody does. He's a quarterback for the Colts. Okay. In the trade with the Eagles.
From North Dakota,
represent. A great decision by him to get surgery, because if he plays less than 75% of the snaps, the Eagles don't get an extra first-round pick from the Colts, which is good for a variety of reasons. So there you go.
Yeah, you seem very excited about that.
Okay.
So I want to check in on that.
Well, as I said, it might be artificially inflated based on the Mucinex.
Okay. Fair enough. I just wanted to check on that. The Mucinex.
You asked for that explanation.
So, I did. I did. And I appreciate it. I just wanted to get a sense of what was going down. All right, folks. Speaking of what's going down, the over the weekend... Really, over the past 5 or 6 days, and we're going to have David Dayan, who's going to come on and give us the TikTok and explain to us, you know, what could have done and who really is at fault here.
And he's not going to dance like in a TikTok. He's going to give us the timeline.
Correct.
He's not going to do the Dougie.
Yeah, this is what I'm talking about. And about a month ago, just to catch everybody up, the CDC's eviction moratorium was challenged at the Supreme Court, and the court upheld the moratorium in a very conditional way. Roberts and Kavanaugh joined the three liberals on the court for a 5-4 decision. Kavanaugh wrote the ruling, and in it, it was a very strange ruling because he said, I don't think this is quite right. However, it's going to expire in a month anyways, July 31st. And it would be too difficult to suddenly cut it off now. That ruling apparently came into play when the administration supposedly, sometime in the last week or so, members of the administration were attempting to convince Joe Biden that the administration should extend this moratorium, the CDC should extend this moratorium, even though the Supreme Court had found that they didn't have a right to issue it in the first place. Now, Kavanaugh's ruling was just sort of bizarre. But there was concern within the White House by the White House lawyers that if this makes it back, and the idea was this, amongst those White House staffers, like Gene Sperling, I think even Deese agreed with it. The idea was, okay, we tie it up in the courts. That will give Treasury more time to get the rental assistance money. And Dane will go into more specifics about this. The rental assistance money that is earmarked for people, it'll get it out the door. There has been billions of dollars available to help people pay their rent.
It's unbelievable how inefficient and how backlogged they are.
I think they've gotten out 4% of the money. I mean,
it's like $4 billion, and then there's $37 billion something still available.
Yeah,
still,
when David's here, Dane will give us the specifics on this. But that's the dynamic, and the idea was like, well, maybe if we have more time, they'll be able to get it out the door. The fear was apparently with the White House lawyers is that may be well and good, but if it ends up at the Supreme Court again, you run the risk of essentially Kavanaugh being punitive, because this is another example of the importance of the Supreme Court, and particularly when you have a bunch of lunatics on it, that they could be punitive and not only say that the CDC, like we said before, the CDC does not have the right to do this. In fact, they could go further and undercut any authority that is based upon the health needs of the country in the context of a pandemic. And make no mistake about it, the Supreme Court has shown their willingness to take the ball when they get it and not just run across the field, but jump on, take the football and run onto the baseball field and onto the basketball court and run through the hockey rink, and they'll go wherever they want with it. Mm-hmm. And that's, part of the concern there. So that's where we're at. And over the weekend, it expired. 2 days before the expiration, the White House basically threw it to Congress, which backfooted a lot of them. They didn't know. I mean, they had been waiting for White House guidance on this. They assumed the White House had some type of plan. Like I say, Dane will give us a better sense of who is really to blame in that dynamic. But there was an opportunity for Congress to stay in session and attempt to deal with this. There were too many people who wanted to leave. The people who stayed, at the very least, members of the squad. Here is Cori Bush and AOC on the Capitol steps on Sunday, trying to draw attention to this and put pressure on their fellow lawmakers. Here's just a brief clip of AOC and Cori Bush talking about staying out there to illustrate the plight of potentially millions of Americans who are going to be evicted. We're going to see a big spike in eviction notices probably filed today. Here is AOC and Cori Bush.
estimated 7 million Americans that are currently at risk for eviction, and Congress decided to leave town for, not just for the weekend, but for 7 weeks.
7 weeks!
Through August. While the federal eviction moratorium is going to leave tomorrow. They didn't even try.
When Cori Bush got elected, we talked about how her experience when she was, houseless is going to be so important to have in Congress. That kind of voice is going to be incalculably important, and we're seeing it this week. And of course, I know we're going to talk to David Day in a bit about who's to blame here, but honestly, the fact that if they wanted to do this through the courts, they didn't have a plan B, a separate track at the ready.
Well, they
in
didn't.
Congress says a little bit about how committed the Biden administration was to actually making this happen. I mean, there's significant lobbying from the National Association of Realtors and groups like that that are, they may want to appear like they want to get this done, but I'm not sure how sincere that is.
That's the point, I think, and Dane will fill us in. But certainly, they had at least 30 days to know that the Supreme Court had that disposition.
Right.
And, on day 30 out from the end of the moratorium is when you have that conversation about, hey, should we just try and buy more time on the 31st day, as opposed to talking about that, 2 days before the moratorium runs out. AOC was on Jake Tapper's. And look, just to build on your point, without an AOC or a Cori Bush in this house, they would have left town. There would have been marginal talk about it, and that's it. I mean, this is the value of them using things like social media and a megaphone to the extent. Now, it may end up doing nothing, but it's certainly putting more attention on it and putting it in play than we would normally see.
Absolutely.
Here is AOC on with Jake Tapper on CNN State of the Union, talking about the moratorium lapse.
Blame here.
Well, I think there's a couple of issues here. First of all, you are absolutely correct in that the House and House leadership had the opportunity to vote to extend the moratorium. And there were many, and there was frankly a handful of conservative Democrats in the House that threatened to get on planes rather than hold this vote. And we have to really just call a spade a spade. We cannot, in good faith, blame the Republican Party when House Democrats have a majority. Now, there is something to be said for the fact that this court order came down on the White House a month ago, and the White House waited until the day before the House adjourned to release a statement asking on Congress to extend the moratorium. This came after weeks. I sit on the Financial Services Committee, which has jurisdiction over housing. We had, the housing secretary there asking about the administration's stance. We asked the Biden administration about their stance, and they were not being really forthright about that advocacy and that request until the day before the House adjourned. And so the House was put into a needlessly difficult situation. And it's not just me saying that. Financial Services Chairwoman Maxine Waters has made that very clear as well. And so there's a couple of contributing factors here. We have governors who are also not getting this emergency rental assistance out in time, which is forcing this extension, what we would like, an extension of the moratorium. The fact of the matter is that the problem is here. The House should reconvene and call this vote and extend the moratorium. There's about 11.
Well, we hear that vacations are very important to some of these Democrats, though. I know that was cinema in the Senate, but
very French. Very French to take all of August off. Except for the part about the housing moratorium, because in France that would have been taken care of.
Right.
Here is Nancy Pelosi today, and I would imagine, again, in reaction to the publicity that AOC and Cori Bush, drummed up over the weekend to
this. And even Maxine Waters, just this amazing image of Maxine Waters slamming their tactic as Pelosi and Hoyer are in the background just watching her criticize them.
Here is the letter that she sent out to members. We put that up. It's a little bit strange here. The war has changed. With these words, the CDC cautioned the difference between the Delta variant has made on the pandemic. They called on the American people to mask up, et cetera, et cetera. Putting people on the streets contributes to the spread of the virus.
It's also just not what we should be doing in a society, but that's a separate point in her opinion.
House Democratic leadership called upon the administration to extend the moratorium. The purpose of this extension, provide more time to expedite the distribution of the $46.5 billion that was allocated by Congress and has long been transferred by the administration to the states and localities. So there's a little bit of CYA going on here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm grateful to members that they are, for all they're doing, attention to this need. We await a decision from the administration. I don't know what that even, like, what is the decision that's going to be made? Once again, I'm sending out the link for members to view the spending in their state and localities to the funds. I do so with the call from members to work in your districts to help to get the money to flow. To this end, we'll have a presentation tomorrow from the Treasury Secretary, Janet Yellen, whose department transfunds the funds early this year. Now, they're going back to their districts, right? And I imagine some are going to be working. Some are going to be on vacation. We all agree the eviction crisis is an enormous challenge to the conscience of our country. It's unfathomable, et cetera, et cetera. Overwhelmingly, our members agreed to extend the moratorium and universally to distribute the funds, but the House passing the eviction moratorium without the Senate acting does not extend the moratorium. Instead, the money must flow. The moratorium must be extended by the administration.
I mean, all right, yeah. So it's they're punting it back and forth, kicking it between the, you know, House leadership and Biden. And I agree that most of this falls on Biden. But Pelosi was aware of the deadline and the cliff of the eviction moratorium and chose not to have a plan in place. Both the White House and leadership, this falls on them. And, you know,
right. I mean, show me a copy of this letter that was sent 3 weeks ago.
Right, exactly.
Oh, no, we're doing what the brutal thing the landlords wanted us to do. How did we get in this position? It's hard. It's really hard for me to believe.
Right. Yeah, if they wanted to whip the votes, they absolutely could whip the votes. And they left it to the last minute on purpose. Then they did a unanimous consent motion so that they could throw this on at the feet of the Republicans when they control the House. And if they had a plan in place, this wouldn't be... this wouldn't be an issue, but they didn't. And I think that's by design, because there are trade groups and lobbying groups that are very invested in this moratorium not continuing.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to David Dayne, who's done quite a bit of reporting on this and the broader question of what's happening with progressives relative to the Biden administration. We'll be right back after this. Oh, we got a new, just coincidentally, we got a new shipment of Liquid IV today.
I saw. I'm having some right now.
I told Bradley, I said, Bradley, choose whatever flavor you want, but don't take the acai.
You did?
Yep.
That's really one of the nicest things you've ever done for me.
That's the nicest thing.
That and also, you know, paying me money.
No, the acai thing was, I think, probably the nicest. Because
I'm into that flavor.
Folks, hot summer months are here. We need to be proactive to keep our bodies fueled up and hydrated.
Body.
One stick of Liquid IV and 16 ounces of water hydrates faster and more efficiently than water alone. Plus, Liquid IV tastes great with flavors like watermelon, strawberry, lemon lime. Sounds like summer, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I'm not going to lie, folks. For me today, pina colada. Yep. There it is. I'm not embarrassed.
It's not as embarrassing as you think it is.
I get mocked about it.
Right.
I get mocked about it like when I go out to bars and I order a pina colada. My friends are like,
well, that's a whole separate situation.
I don't know. It's just, I think a grown man who has like a pina colada habit is just a weird thing. But
yeah, well.
But it actually, I love it. I love the taste of coconut. Whatever. It doesn't matter. Usually I go with the matcha. It's just, it depends on different days. Today, I had like half a cup of coffee, so I was like, okay, I'm going with the pina colada. It is healthier than sugary sports drinks. There are no artificial flavors or preservatives, less sugar than an apple. They also have an apple as a flavor, too.
Mm.
Yeah,
it's good. You love apples.
I like the sour apple flavor, too. A liquid IV is powered by cellular transport technology. The optimal ratio of glucose, sodium, and potassium delivers water and nutrients into the bloodstream. The company has donated over 4 million servings in response to COVID-19. Products are being donated to hospitals, first responders, food banks, and more. Did I mention it has five essential items to vitamins? Vitamin C, more than an orange. More potassium than a banana. When Saul was playing baseball, the summer hasn't been quite as hot as it used to be. But I mean, as I remember most summers, but the beginning part were, and he was playing baseball and he was getting dehydrated and he was like, "Can I get one of those? You know, one of the sugary sports drinks that are like, wait, how does it get that color? That's not natural." And but I would fill up some water bottles of this, and I felt better about it because you need to hydrate, and you don't necessarily want all that garbage. And he liked it. He likes all the flavors, frankly. So check it out. It's also great if you maybe celebrate a little too much with the booze, or if you're flying. Or, like I say, that matcha drink I use is a substitute for coffee now. Mm. And I'm also getting hydrated at the same time. Grab your Liquid IV in bulk at nationwide at Costco. You can get 25% off when you go to liquidiv.com. Use the code MajorityRep. It's MajorityRep at checkout. MajorityRep. That's 25% off anything you order when you get better hydration today using the promo code MajorityRep at liquidiv.com. Okay, I want to welcome back to the program the executive editor of the American Prospect, David Dayan. David, welcome. I'm here with Emma Vigeland.
Just a second. Thanks for having me on the show, Jimmy. I really appreciate it. And I prioritize you over Sam. So thank you.
All right,
I'm ready. I'm ready.
Well, David. There we go.
Yeah,
Getting back to David's roots. I think we've mentioned in the past that David and I first met 30 years
ago. Yeah, I was doing some acting there. You like that?
30 years. We met on a student film.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, and then we reconnected, I think, probably over a decade later. So,
And here we are.
And here we are.
And we are.
Say, David is here to talk about the where we are with the eviction moratorium. And broadly speaking, a piece that Alex Salmon wrote in The Prospect about the progressive relationship with the Biden administration at this point and where we're at. But I just wanted to mention, David, I imagine you're aware of this. You came out with a massive piece today.
Aware that you wrote your piece?
I am aware of what I wrote, yeah.
It is Anatomy of an Anti-Union Meeting, How No Evil Foods, which is a plant-based meat company, squashed a union drive. I'm just into the first couple of pages. It's fascinating and really important, too, I think, in this era when ostensibly we're going to see a more aggressive labor department where we've begun to see, I think, over the past couple of years, a more aggressive union movement in this country. Really important read, and I hope to talk to you about that piece in the coming weeks, but people should go check that piece out.
In the meantime,
we laid out a little bit of the dynamic that's going on with this moratorium. Give us a TikTok of like how we got to where we are today, 2 days after the moratorium has been essentially expired, and really probably the first day where we're seeing filings of new eviction notices.
Yeah, absolutely. So as you know, there was an eviction moratorium that was put in statute way back with the CARES Act and I think that extended to September, and then by the Trump administration was extended again to January. And Biden picked up where that left off and extended it out two more times, I believe, once to March and then another time to June of 2021.
Let me just ask this. Why were they doing it 2 months at a time? Was it?
Yeah, why were they doing it piecemeal? Because, well, this was an order from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. You might ask, why did they have any control over housing policy and evictions? And it was based on the need to protect people with regard to coronavirus. You obviously can't shelter in place unless you have shelter. So it was based on events and facts on the ground and things like that. And they were using the national emergency as a spur to do these eviction moratoria. I think the first one was the changeover from the one administration to the next. So, Trump put it in place until 10 days after he left office, which is a very Trumpian thing to do. And then I don't remember. I think they initially extended it very quickly, the Biden administration, when they got in place, to March and then again to June. And then in June, at the end of June, there was a third extension, and it was made very clear at that point that that would be the last one. I mean, the Biden administration was explicit about this. They said, we're going to extend this for one more month, and then that's all we're going to do. And so at the same time, there were these lawsuits going on with respect to the moratorium, saying CDC didn't have the authority to actually do these evictions and whatnot. And one of those cases went all the way up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court actually said, this is okay. We're going to allow the eviction moratorium to continue. However, in a footnote, not binding in any way, it wasn't part of the ruling, but in a footnote, Brett Kavanaugh, who is one of the members of this majority, it was a 5-4 majority to allow the eviction moratorium to continue. Kavanaugh said, I'm only allowing this because you're doing it only for another month. And if you try to do it again after that, I'm going to need to see more congressional authorization. That was put out on June 29th. And again, that was not binding. That was Kavanaugh's opinion. Now, I mean, Kavanaugh probably would if they CDC tried to extend again without congressional input. Kavanaugh might have followed through on that and said, yes, we are going to knock this down. However, it just wasn't part of the ruling. It was a footnote in the ruling. That came out on June 29th. The Biden administration says nothing about the eviction moratorium for 1 month. They do not signal to Congress, at least not publicly, that, this is what the ruling said. Congress, you need to go ahead and extend this. The only thing that was out in public was, we're not extending this again. That was the Biden administration's position, was this is over on July 31st. And that was their position right up until July 29th, when Jen Psaki, press secretary, gives a statement saying, well, Kavanaugh said this and Congress has to take action. And hey, Congress, you should do something. Now, at this point, it's 1 day before the House's recess for 7 weeks, and it's 2 days before the end of the moratorium. So the House then tries to put together a bill. They can't get it done. There are a few moderates that are wishy-washy on it. And anyway, they're trying to put this together in 1 day. There's no real time to persuade anybody. And they abort. They don't end up even voting on it. And they kick it back to Biden. The finger pointing ensues here. So the House says, this is the administration's fault, and the administration, CDC, should extend. And CDC says, we're not allowed to extend. Congress should pass a law. And none of this matters to the family of four who is behind on their rent and is going to be kicked out on the street imminently. And the larger context here is that Congress appropriated $46 billion for emergency rental assistance that was supposed to get into the hands of people so that there would be almost none or none of people in arrears at the point that the eviction moratorium took effect. However, in the first 6 months of that program, of the $46 billion available, only $3 billion has gone out the door. And this is for a variety of reasons, because of poor program design and poor implementation. And so extending the moratorium without actually getting the money into the hands of people so they don't have this back rent that is due is the critical thing. And yet that there's been a total failure on that front in the background of the finger pointing between everybody.
All right. There's a lot of, I have a lot of questions about that, but what is the, if there are evictions, right, that take place now, I'm just trying to think like, you know, what could potentially mitigate the rush to evict. And I think it's unlikely it will, but are you, as a landlord, are you eligible for that back rent if you've evicted the person? Like, can't they?
No, but interestingly enough, landlords who would benefit absolutely from the emergency rental assistance, this doesn't only help renters. It the money flows from the renter to the landlord.
I imagine it. Sometimes it goes directly to the landlord, right? I mean, don't they have the ability to apply?
Well, here's the thing. The landlord has the ability not only to accept emergency rental assistance, but to reject emergency rental assistance. Now you ask, why would they reject money that's coming to them? Well, what if they live in an apartment? What if they own this apartment and the renters in there who aren't paying are paying $1,000 a month, but they think they can get $2,000 a month for it? Well, yeah, they'd reject the money and then kick them out at the earliest opportunity and bring somebody in who's going to pay much more for that unit. And so that's the calculations that are being made because the program design allowed the landlord to reject the money.
Why?
Exactly. This is a very strange program, the way it was designed. They literally had to stand up hundreds of state and local emergency rental assistance programs that were mostly put together by nonprofits. There is no federal authority that is doing this. It's all been devolved to the states and the cities. And that's where a lot of these problems are coming up. It's very inconsistent. It's confusing. It's hard for people who are renters to know where to go to access rental assistance. There's a lot of paperwork involved. There's this this insane provision that the landlords can reject the money. We have been hearing about this is not new. We've right. been hearing about this for months and months and months since practically when it started in January. We've been hearing that it's hard to get this money out. It's hard to get this money out. In fact, the administration just a week or two ago bragged that in June, more money got out on rental assistance than in the previous 5 months combined, without the context that we're only talking about $1.5 billion in the month of June and right. $1.5 billion in the five previous months combined when you had $46 billion. Now, a really insane statement came out from Biden I believe it was the day before the eviction moratorium was to expire, saying, we need these cities and states at their fastest opportunity to get this money out to people. Like it was Brewster's Millions. They had to spend $43 billion in 24 hours after having spent none or close to none in the previous 6 months. It's ridiculous. And the buck passing here is certainly doesn't show any sort of leadership.
We should just also to add the context here. California and New York, at least those two states, have in place their own eviction moratorium that is distinct from the CDC one, right? I mean, so this is running concurrently. My understanding, too, is that New York has been absolutely horrid in getting this money out. New York State, like maybe one of the worst states in the country. They still have a moratorium, at least, so there's some protection there while they figure it out. But
I believe there's a total of 8 states that have existing moratorium. There may be more cities, you know, within that have local ordinances, because traditionally renting and this stuff is done at the local level. But you know, you still have that's a lot of states that have nothing in place.
Is there any example across the country of a municipality just seems so small of a measure, but of any state that has actually like figured out a way of doing this efficiently? I mean, that's extraordinary. The failure to get this money out. It's extraordinary.
I wish it was extraordinary. And I wish it was extraordinary. I think it's very, very ordinary, in fact. And, you know, I have visions of HAMP running in my head, of the mortgage modification program that spent $2 billion out of its $50 billion or whatever in 2 years. You know, I don't know if you have read the piece in The Atlantic by Annie Lowry called The Time Tax. And I've written about this too. It's about the hassle that it takes to access benefits if you're someone who is eligible for them in America. It's a tax. It's a literal tax on people's time. We all have to become bureaucrats because we've shrunk the administrative state to such a degree that we have to do the work of the government to fill out forms and double check and call people and do all this administrative work. This is part and parcel with that. And it's worse, actually, because there wasn't even an existing program to tap into. They were literally building these programs on the fly to create, you know, rental assistance measures. This is far too normal. This is depressingly normal when it comes to America. In the last year, we've been really, really good at appropriating money to get to people. And we've been really, really bad at actually getting the money to people. I did a piece on this just last week. There's an emergency broadband program in the American Rescue Plan that says we're going to pay $50 a month for your broadband because we know you need it because of, you know, working remotely and things like that. 1 in 12 eligible people have accessed that program. There's the advanced child tax credit. That is eligible. It's the simplest model in the world. If you're in the IRS's system and you have kids, you get a check every month. Well, if you're not in the IRS system because you're not a tax filer, which is the case for most poor people in America, you have to figure out a way to get into the IRS's system. How many people have been able to do that? Less than 1 in 10. This is a very consistent number. Less than 1 in 10 of the people who are eligible for these programs actually are able to access them. And we have to do something massive about that.
All right, let's talk a little bit about that before I want to return to sort of the, you know, what could have been done in real time. But what we're talking about is a legacy problem that we have in this country that we are just not built as a country to help people. And we can't.
No. We're built to help certain people.
Well, yeah.
Certain classes of people.
Exactly.
We're not built to help people who need the help.
This is a big problem, like literally a big problem, right? I mean, insofar as we don't have the mechanism to deliver help to people who are the first people to need help, particularly in the context of a crisis. But even in a so-called non-nationwide crisis, we're not built to help people who are in their own individual crises. What's the answer to this beyond, let's say, like, hey, if we had a Medicare for all type system, then everybody would have health care. We wouldn't have to have 14 different programs to cover people. If we had a...
That is part of the answer, right? It is universalization. If you don't have to means test then you don't have to have forms filled out in triplicate to make sure that you're not, you know, a greedy bastard getting away with accessing a program that you're not supposed to be allowed to access. So that is part of the answer, is universal benefits. Another answer is federalization of benefits. I mean, think about all of the stories we've heard on both sides of this, of people, ordinary people having trouble accessing unemployment insurance, and spammers and scammer artists having no trouble accessing unemployment insurance and taking billions of dollars out of the system for their own purposes. These state level systems are not funded well. They're not equipped to handle a crush of applicants. And you know, so we could have federalized rental assistance and made it much easier. But simplification is the third sense. So is it universalization, federalization, and simplification? We have to make these programs as easy as humanly possible. And we just don't even think about that, because the class of people who are writing these laws and implementing these laws generally never had to access these benefits.
Let's talk about this. There's a piece in ProPublica that covers the scale of the fraud associated with unemployment insurance. And I want to be clear here. It is not people who are eligible for this program who are scamming the program. I mean, it's literally international rings of criminals who are going on, and they're taking advantage of the fact that it is a state by state program, and people are applying in multiple states, and we don't have a mechanism really to figure that out. There are, it's also a function of the PUA, which is the expanded unemployment insurance that covers people who work like gig jobs, essentially. And
it was a great thing.
A great thing. We have no apparatus because we've never covered those people.
Well, it's not that we have no apparatus, it's that we didn't require the kind of double checks that they require with the regular unemployment system. So you didn't have to check with an employer to see if that person was employed. And right. I mean, there are legitimate hardships there. I mean, if you're talking about someone who's self-employed that tries to get on unemployment, what employer are you checking with? Like you're checking with the same person, right? So, I mean, there are issues that you have to work out there, but certainly the states weren't going to work out those issues. I mean, I remember at the beginning of the pandemic, hearing about how a lot of these state-based unemployment systems, their computer systems, used the COBOL programming language, which died out in the 50s. Yeah. And they were there was this thing where the governor of New Jersey was at a press conference saying, if there's anyone out there who knows how to use COBOL, please call the state of New Jersey, because we have a problem with our unemployment system. Like this is absurd. And we would not accept it. Nobody would accept this if this was for mortgage deductions. Right. If this was for bank bailouts. This would be completely unacceptable.
Why is it just simply that there's an absence of political power on the receiving end of these benefits, that we don't get any movement to federalize it? Or is it that there are headwinds in that there are people in Congress who don't want, who see federalization as problematic?
Well, I mean, I think that there's an entire party that sees benefit delivery as problematic and that sees government as problematic. And I think they're the party that is resisting making this easier, because if you make it easier, then you're going to get all these layabouts who, you know, aren't going to be able to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. So, I mean, that's one part of it. The other thing is we just don't have a tradition of solid benefit delivery. The one reason why our coronavirus support was so expansive is because we were literally replacing a social safety net that didn't exist on the fly. I mean, they're just, you know, if we did nothing, there are no automatic stabilizers, or very few, I should say, ways in which to keep people afloat in that situation. And so we just didn't have a lot of experience with this kind of benefit delivery. But even those programs that we already had previously were run badly, and it's, they're not valued. I mean, they're just not valued by our political system.
So what can be done now? I mean, does the Biden administration extend it? I mean, I've been reading the reporting saying that they had contemplated extending it in, despite, you know, Kavanaugh's addendum there, but there were concerns by White House lawyers who were basically saying, if you do that, you run the risk of losing the authority for other things, because it's not certainly beyond Kavanaugh to be, and the rest of them, to be punitive in that instance.
I mean, I think that's a little overly cautious. The one thing about this is, so this was a CDC order, so it was tied to the pandemic, right? The circumstances on June 29th and the circumstances today on August 2nd are radically different. I think there are six times as many daily cases now as there were on June 29th. There is a colorable argument for the CDC to say, we made the determination that we made to only extend this by a month based on the data that we had in June. And we now have data in August that shows the coronavirus is still an enormous pressing problem in the United States. And you can't, you know, people have to be protected.
Right.
You can't shelter in place without shelter. And so we need to extend this. There's, to me, that's an argument that could be made to the court. And, you know, yes, ideology being what it is, maybe Kavanaugh doesn't buy that, but it's going to take some time to work through the system, right? And in that time, you could actually try to get more of the money out from the rental assistance program. And you can keep people housed for that much more time. Like, why wouldn't you try to do that? I'm not sure I buy the argument that you're going to lose other emergency programs. Meanwhile, what emergency programs? You're rapidly getting rid of those too. The extended unemployment benefits end in September. The pause on student loan payments also end in September. There doesn't seem to be a lot of momentum in the White House to extend either of those. So what emergency programs are you going to lose? Are you just saying that the next pandemic 10 years from now, we're going to not have these authorities available? I don't know what the worry is, but I know that there's a near-term problem of millions of people being threatened with their homes, and I think that takes priority.
Well, that brings us back to there's not really a will. I mean, that's I think part of what we're seeing with the White House, and I think they were hoping that essentially the vaccination rate wouldn't be where we're at today, and that we wouldn't be in the situation with the Delta variant. So they were caught flat-footed. But then there's also just not this will, because there is like a significant amount of lobbying, which I want to return to, from the National Association of Realtors and other groups. Can you just talk a little bit about some of the interests behind the scenes that are pushing against this eviction moratorium?
Oh, I mean, certainly. I mean, that's why we had the lawsuit. You know, that's who was pushing the lawsuit. We're rent realtor groups in various states. And that's why we went up to the Supreme Court and got this to begin with. So, yeah, the realtors do not want the eviction moratorium to stay in place. There's no doubt. And certainly the realtors have a lot of purchase both within Congress and presumably at some level within parts of the White House. So that's certainly the case. I think you need only look at the headlines to come to understand what a huge political loser this is for the Biden administration. And, you know, the last midterm election of a Democratic president 11 years ago, but it will be 12 by the time of the next midterm, was happening under the circumstances of the foreclosure crisis, when millions of people also were losing their homes. And I remember talking to House members who were sending out canvassers to go to parts of their district and talk to people about the next election, and going to entire streets and finding one occupied house on that street. And you know, when people are transient, when people are unhoused, when people are moving around, they're not thinking about the next election, certainly, and they're not worried about it. So I don't know how long this lingers, and I don't know, you know, obviously we're in a better economic environment, and maybe people can fall, you know, land on their feet, and maybe I'm overhyping this as a problem, but I know what happened last time. And the mass eviction of people was a major contributing factor to the Democratic wipeout. And will it be a contributing factor again? Remains to be seen. But I don't think you tempt fate.
We should add, too, that with all the voting restrictions that have taken place in a lot of these states, that adds to the complications in terms of, like, maybe they're not getting their notice from the registrars because their address has changed. Maybe they haven't changed their address. You're going to see a lot of ballots invalidated because of that, you know, 14.
And the whole argument now from the Biden administration is we're just going to out organize them. OK, they changed the rules, but we're just going to out organize them. Well, how do you do that when an entire apartment building has been eliminated of the current tenants and new tenants have moved in?
I mean, and to be clear, we're just talking about the most sort of like cynical motivations that you would hope.
Exactly. Like, yeah, exactly.
The party would react to, as opposed to just the sheer immiseration of, you know, potentially millions of people who are going to get thrown.
There's a moral urgency. Yeah, absolutely. There's a moral urgency here. And certainly the political leadership. This is a low point of the Biden presidency.
All right. We just got a couple of minutes left. I mean, talk about that, because presumably, right, Congress is not going to be able to do anything for 7 weeks. And then I don't know if they would have been able to do anything anyways, right? Because it would have had to pass the Senate. Unlikely. I don't know how likely that would have been in the Senate. It seems to me. So what is your sense of how the White House is reacting to it? I mean, I'm not saying that the White House is monitoring the show, but the idea of AOC and Cori Bush on the steps of the Capitol last night and then, you know, showing up on the Sunday talk shows. This is the type of pressure that makes the administration look bad. And hopefully they see this as they're paying a political price, and hopefully will at the very least attempt to do something.
Well, I mean, in part, the die has been cast, right? I mean, we're in an environment without a moratorium now, and legally might be more difficult to restart a moratorium than to extend one. I mean, I don't know all the particulars of that, but it may be a problem. The urgency certainly wasn't there throughout the month of July, and that was the critical time at which this needed to be dealt with. And now, I mean, they put up, like, CFPB put up a tool, like, you can put in your zip code and figure out which of the hundreds of agencies that do this actually is your agency that can help you with rental assistance. But that's just a weak substitute.
Well, so where was the failure point here? Was it with Congress? I mean, should we have been hearing more from our Congress people? Was it a media failure in terms of, like, not, you know, investigating the implications of what was happening? I mean, where's the failure lie?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of
anything on it. We didn't, you know, we would mention it briefly, like, we're a month out, but with the presumption of, like, somebody will deal with it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's on the media or activists who said, oh, well, maybe we took our eye off the ball. I mean, like, it's the job of the president not to take their eye off the ball, right? Like, that's not something that I have to deal with. That's not something that you have to deal with necessarily, but it's certainly something the president has to deal with. My view is that there are two failure points here. One was the failure to get out this rental assistance, and that goes back to the writing of the statute back at last December. The second is that month of inaction between the time of the Supreme Court ruling and the time of Jen Psaki's statement on July 29th. I mean, what was happening there? We needed quick action, a quick game plan, so that we had some time, like, to convince House members, recalcitrant moderates, and move this to the Senate, where you could build that momentum and pay a political price, and maybe try to get some action there. To me, it's those two things. So that's more of a White House, but also Congress in terms of the design.
You have a piece in the American Prospect, Alex Salmon wrote it, about the sort of sense that that in some respects, the progressive groups that deal with the White House, that are there to push Joe Biden, have been sort of co-opted. We just have a couple minutes left. I mean, give us just sort of maybe the top line there, but what that dynamic is about, and whether you think that dynamic is set in stone, or if it's if there's a potential for a change.
So under the Obama administration, there was this weekly meeting that was called Common Purpose. And it was essentially a meeting where Rahm Emanuel, who was chief of staff at that time, would come in and berate progressive groups over, you know, what they were doing to try to move other Democrats. And he would yell at them and tell them to stop. And so it was very much a stick in terms of how the Obama administration dealt with the left, and they ignored the left, and they paid, you know, whatever price they paid. This administration, it's more of the carrot. So there's a lot of access. There's a lot of talking. Ron Klain is seen as an ally, and he talks to a lot of these groups on a very consistent basis. But whether it shows up in policy is scattershot. I mean, sometimes it does. But look at this thing. Look at what we've been talking about for the last half hour. Were progressive groups using this access that they had to influence the White House to do something on preventing the eviction moratorium from expiring or getting rental assistance out in a bigger way? I know there are some very small housing groups that were certainly agitating in that direction, but I'm talking about the big groups. I'm talking about the Center for American Progress. I'm talking about, you know, the groups that have the influence at the top. It seems like they were interested more in getting that access and going to the White House to have strategy sessions than to actually influence policy. And so Alex's piece kind of gets at that of, you know, there's a difference between access and influence.
Right. And I guess this is a good example of, you know, and it's to the detriment of the administration ultimately too, right? I mean, because if these groups are not doing their job in pushing the White House, you end up with this type of crap show.
Yeah, I mean, there's an old story about Bernie Sanders going to the White House under Clinton for some bill signing with regard to healthcare. And that Clinton goes up to Sanders and says, you should have pushed me more. You should have pushed me more and forced me to sign a stronger bill than this. Now, I mean, that's Bill Clinton being Bill Clinton at one level. But at the other level, it's setting up the relationship between, I mean, Bernie was in Congress, but he was sort of like an activist in Congress, especially in the 90s. It's setting up that relationship between activists and establishment politicians and policymakers, that relationship is at some level adversarial, and it's mutually beneficial to be adversarial. And when it's not adversarial, when it's a mutual admiration society, then you don't get the proper amount of pressure and leverage to actually get change rolling. And so I think that's an important lesson here that progressive groups have to think about. Are we going to sort of make nice, censor ourselves, try to use our insider game to move the needle on policy? Or are we going to be willing to be adversaries in the pursuit of a progressive goal?
Right. And a lot of times it will help those politicians, because they look around and say, look, guys, you got to help me out here because I got these people clamoring at my door. David Dayan, American Prospect at prospect.org. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
All right, folks, quick break. Then we'll be back. Wrap it up. There you have it, folks. I guess it remains to be seen how the administration will react in this instance to at least this negative publicity. But there's a lot of people who are going to be hurting out there. And I don't know. I don't know how they expedite this money for the rental assistance, but something's got to be figured out soon. Just for the sheer suffering that it's going to cause. Never mind the pandemic, and then never mind the elections as they come. But for those of us watching on Peacock, we say adieu. Or no, wait a second. I understand that is
au revoir.
Au revoir. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, see you tomorrow. And for those of you sticking around, we say bonjour.
Aloha means hello, right? And goodbye.
I'm just working on my
Were you good at languages in school?
No.
Me neither.
I wasn't. There was not. I'm not going to lie. There wasn't a lot that I was good at school. I mean, that's, that last point, I think, is a really important one. And, you know, there are versions of that that can go sideways. One of the things, you know, it's been a ongoing conversation about force the vote. And one of the things why I initially was supportive of the effort is because I do believe that it is the role of people who are, you know, supporters or activists of, just citizens to push their politicians. I think it also can sometimes be you're pushing them for something that makes no sense. And that was what ultimately was the problem with that. Is it not so much the broad tactic of pushing your politicians. You want that to happen.
Right.
The politicians, the good ones, the ones that are decent, also want that to happen because they want to be boxed in to make certain decisions because it gives them some measure of cover. But you also want to do it for like some actual gains.
Yeah. We had Ben Spielberg on Left Reckoning last week to talk about this exact dynamic of how to do this correctly. And I think the problem the squad had is anytime that they get something, Biden also says, oh yeah, I wanted that too. We're not in a situation where they push for something that Biden like can't own. Right. And it'd be nice to like, I don't know if they're like, if structurally it's possible where they can say, I mean, AOC is talking about sinking the bipartisan bill now, like that muscle needs to get exercised. And the problem with force of vote is it didn't really like it narrowed the exercise way too much to where we forgot that, oh, we're supposed to exact a price from Pelosi to continue supporting her. That's fundamentally what we need. And we didn't really even get as good of a price because all the noise.
Well, the narrowing was a part of a particular project.
The narrowing wasn't about extracting more from Dems. It was about a referendum on the project of the squad.
Exactly.
Exactly.
And that was what ultimately, you know, ended up being the when I left the bus on that.
Well, but it's important to keep asking Cori Bush about it as she's on the steps camping out about the eviction moratorium.
Right.
All
right, look, we're gonna take a break and head into the fun half. And when we do, we're gonna be talking to Ben Dixon, who is been canvassing in Ohio for Nina Turner and get a sense of what's happening there. This is a very important race, speaking of the squad, et cetera, et cetera. Just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com. You support the free show. You get the show free show free of commercials. And then you get extra content virtually every single day. We cannot do it without you. It is our members that make it possible. If you are listening to the show on a regular basis and you have the funds to do so, become a member today and support the show. Also, don't forget, we got merch. I want to make something clear. I did not lose Ronald Reagan's shirt. Mm. I've got the Ronald Reagan shirt, and I'm going to wear that.
Where is it?
With the sun's out, guns out. I've got it. Secret place in the safe.
Okay, so you found it while
no,
I was in the bathroom?
I have that. I haven't. I can't find the Majority Report one, but maybe I'll just wear the round. People don't care.
I want the Majority Report one.
Well, I don't know where it is. Somebody stole it. Also, MajorityDiscord.com. Check it out. And yes, we'll play that Dan Arkey. And oh, I have seen the Crowder Nightmare
animation,
and we will talk about that, and then we will do more than just talk about it. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lekian media universe
tonight? Only for patrons at patreon.com/leftreckoning. David Griscom and I are going to do a think tank. So, and also over this weekend, David and I were both on This Is Revolution with Pascal, Jason, and
oh, nice.
Gene. Had a fun talk with them and a fun post show gossip session. So, check that out at This Is Revolution YouTube and patreon.com/leftreckoning to hear David and I live tonight on the think tank.
Gossip. I thought that was counter-revolutionary. No?
No, this is revolutionary gossip.
don't forget, also, Nomi's show, Wednesdays and Fridays. YouTube.com.
I'm unsure. /
the Nomiki show. That's it. All right, folks, see you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Danarchy. Alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
Can you bring back DJ Danarchy?
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Danarchy.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
You see, white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych. Fuck them.
Snowflake says what? What? Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
Lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black African. And the alpha males are black. And the Africans are back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! fuck them. Fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan. By the way, it's my birthday. Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Back. Africans are black. Black. Alpha males are black. Black. Africans are back. Back.
Come on. To pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total pussy.